It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. He'll talk about that leak of the NSA hack tools from the Equation Group. What does it mean? What does it mean? What could they be? He'll also give us a little insight into the microkernel, how it works, what it is, and a look at a very interesting router operating system. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 574, recorded Tuesday, August 23rd, 2016. Routers and microkernels. Security Now is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans brings the mortgage process into the 21st century with a fast, easy, and completely online process. Check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/securitynow. And by audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/securitynow. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover the latest security, keep you safe and sound online with this guy right here. I feel like I'm sitting next to you. This is nice. Steve Gibson.
So normally that screen used to be much further behind you.
Right? Yeah.
So you sort of couldn't catch me out of the corner of your eye.
No, I had to kind of turn completely. And I did a TV turn, which was cheat, and look over there. It would look like I was looking at you, but I'm really looking over there. We are temporarily discombobulated because we're going to be moving back into my office next time. But for now, we're in the main studio because, as you know, I bet you can imagine moving a whole studio. Oh,
I don't know how you did it. Basically on the fly.
On the fly. And so I made completely impossible constraints on these guys, and I feel so bad for it, and I'm sorry, John. Because first of all, they said, well, it's going to take us 5 days. I said, I can't miss 5 days of shows. 3 days? I said, I can't. I'm not going to miss any shows. I'm not going to miss any shows. And they said, oh, okay. 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 And then to add to the horror, I said, and we're not going to buy, and they said, well, we can buy duplicate gear, right? Or rent it or something. I said, no.
No. Long cables.
No. You get one of everything. And then, not my fault, but the tenant improvements by the owner. Well, first of all, the building got sold during the tenant improvements, so we leased it from one guy, and now it's a different guy owning it. So the tenant improvements dragged on. We were supposed to get this 6 weeks ago. We got it 1 week ago, basically. So there was little we could do ahead of time. And then most of that would have been studio building, right? And like the bricks that are supposed to be there and, you know, all that stuff. So we could only do a bare bones studio. But I said, no, don't worry. Everybody's going to understand that for the first few weeks in a new place, we're going to be, you know, it's going to be like in a new house. You're still finishing up the stuff, painting. And
you got stuff in boxes still.
Oh, lots. Lots. And then, but secondarily, most people just listen. And so what I said is, if we can do a show, if we can do audio shows that look okay, I'll be happy. And they don't have to be, we can do everything at the round table, which we are, until the other studios are ready. And the last studio to go was mine because that was the last studio used in the brick house. They're actually surprisingly complete. The desk is over, the backdrop is over, the lights are in. We just have to wire the sound. That'll be ready on Saturday for the radio show. And then after that, I'll be doing this show and Windows Weekly from my office again.
So not only is this the first Security Now in the new studio.
Yes.
This is the first Security Now of year 12.
So we'll always know when we moved. We moved in year 12.
That's right.
Year 11 to year 12. Wow.
That's
year,
right.
Year 12.
10 years from now.
This show's going to be a teenager now, next year. Junior high school.
So, wow. Lots of stuff to talk about. Our main topics that we will get to is I discovered something very surprising in the hardware of all consumer routers, almost without exception, which is it's distressingly unused capability that just isn't it's physically there in the hardware but isn't surfaced to a user interface. DDWRT is beginning to make some inroads into it, so that's I want to talk about that a little bit. And I wanted to also do a little bit of a just a little sidestep into the topic of microkernels, because we're all living on top of operating systems, and there's been a lot of microkernel discussion in the news. So I want to toward the end of the podcast talk about those things. But there was a lot of news of the week, of course. The question, we'll answer the question, or look at it at least, about whether the so-called shadow broker group hacked the NSA's equation group. Note that Apple's bug bounty was quickly outbid. A critical flaw has been discovered in the random number generator of GNU-PG. The EFF has weighed in on Windows 10. Chrome browser is frightening people unnecessarily, and I've had a bunch of reports about that. Then a Johns Hopkins team of cryptographers led by Matthew Green presented a paper at the 25th annual Usenix conference a couple weeks ago disclosing a series of weaknesses in Apple's iMessage technology, which, for example, just to give you a little tease, allows for retrospective decryption of encrypted iMessages. So so there's that. And then somebody posed a question actually this morning through Twitter that I really liked. And I thought, this is a perfect puzzler of the week for our listeners. So we will finish the podcast with the question this guy asked, because and it's just something for our listeners to think about for a week, and then we'll talk about it next week. So I think lots of fun stuff.
All good topics, and since the garbage men have arrived, I think this would be good.
Perfect timing.
I'm actually really interested in what your take is on the equation group. We talked a little bit about it because it was just breaking last week, but I know we know a lot more now, and I'd really like to know what you think about that whole thing. But first, let's take a break and talk about Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. You know, I love it. One of the reasons Quicken Loans decided to do ads for Rocket Mortgage on Security Now is because they know that if you're listening to Security Now, you're pretty much bought into the whole computer thing, the whole internet thing, the whole technology thing. And in all likelihood, the last thing you want to do is gather together a bunch of papers, you know, shuffle through documents and stuff, put them all in a banker's box and schlep them down to the mortgage broker's office and say, please, sir, can I have a loan? It's not you. It's not me. It's not us. So they created a loan product that is so great for the digital generation, for us, for you, called Rocket Mortgage. And they named it Rocket Mortgage because, boom, it's fast, it's powerful, and it's completely online, because all rockets are no, that's not right. But I don't know why the online stuff has anything to do with rockets, but it's fast, and that's key. Rocket Mortgage has taken all the complicated, time-consuming paperwork out of applying for a mortgage. Hate searching through stacks of old files and paperwork? Well, you'll be loving this, because with Rocket Mortgage, you just share your bank statements, your pay stubs, with a push of a button. You'll be approved very quickly. I mean, in most cases, minutes, and you'll be getting a custom mortgage solution that's tailored to your unique financial situation, because it's all online. It's all computers. There's nobody going through it, but tables going, well, let me see what would be right. It's just boom, boom, boom. And with Rocket Mortgage, you don't even have to get up from the couch, because you can do it on your tablet or your phone. This is as easy as can be. It's a quick online process you can manage from the convenience of your couch. You can do it lying in bed. So look, if it's time to refi, and it might be, those mortgage rates are really low, and I don't know how long they're going to stay that way. Maybe you're ready to buy a house or ready to trade up to a new house. You don't have to do it the old way. You can go to Rocket Mortgage. They're at quickenloans.com/securitynow. quickenloans.com/securitynow. Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, and MLS. ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030. We thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of Security Now. quickenloans.com slash security now. All right, Steve. I'm listening with all ears.
Our picture of the week, which is in the show notes, is just a fun T-shirt, which our listeners will appreciate and which would confuse pretty much any normal people who would think, what? How does that make any sense? And, of course, we all remember the 100 bottles of beer on the wall.
I just saw it. I love it.
Isn't that great? So we all remember the 100 bottles of beer on the wall song where you take one down and pass it around and then there's 99. So this T-shirt reads, 99 little bugs in the code, 99 little bugs. Take one down, patch it around, 117 little bugs in the code. And so it's like, that's the lesson we learned. You have to be so careful when you think you're fixing something.
So easy.
It's just as likely that you're going to add some more problems.
Tis indeed.
So, okay. Probably the top story of the week was this whole NSA hacker group shadow brokers deal. I've read in as much as I can from what's available publicly. And, you know, attribution is famously difficult. You'll remember that I was reluctant for the longest time on the topic of Stuxnet to ascribe this to the U.S. and Israel, who we now – it's sort of – there again, no absolute proof, but the consensus has sort of been, we're as sure as we could be that that's – that, you know, that it was state-sponsored and probably – you know, the U.S. and Israeli intelligence groups, the cyber groups. So what happened here in this case is that a group calling themselves the Shadow Brokers posted a bunch of data, but only a taste of what they have, 256 megs of compressed stuff, predominantly batch scripts and what was regarded as unimpressively coded Python. So the people looking at it were unimpressed by it. And in fact, I saw one massive compound if statement checking the version of the Cisco ASA software that was running. And I have to say, it's not the way I would have written the code. So who's to know? But they posted this with the claim that they had hacked into the NSA's equation group. Now, one of the things that I immediately sort of caught my attention was that if you actually read the posting, and I'm going to let everyone see what you think, because I'm going to read the introduction paragraph exactly as it's written. Tell me if you think it's actually somebody who can't speak English or somebody who's doing a bad pretend, a bad emulation of a non-English speaker. So they said, how much you pay for enemies' cyber weapons, not malware you find in networks. Both sides, RAT and LP, full state sponsor tool set. We find cyber weapons made by creators of Stuxnet, Dooku, Flame. Kaspersky calls Equation Group. We follow Equation Group traffic. We find Equation Group source range. We hack Equation Group. We find many, many Equation Group cyber weapons. You see pictures. We give you some Equation Group files, you see. This is good proof, no? You enjoy. You break many things. You find many intrusions. You write many words. But not all. We are auction the best files. Now,
that's Chinese, by the way. That is almost certainly Chinese syntax.
Okay. To me, it reads as fake.
Well, like, or if you were faking Chinese syntax.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah.
But for example,
When you say good, you often say how, which is good.
But say we find cyber weapons made by creators of that to me
is
like
Russian.
Some correct English slipped in there.
Yeah.
When they were trying to make it seem sort of jilted and stilted. So I don't know.
I was a Chinese major. My Chinese isn't great, but I do kind of recognize a Chinese style syntax. There's not a lot of, for instance, Chinese doesn't have tenses. It feels to me a little bit like it would be either Chinese or somebody pretending. You're right. And hackers obviously want to obfuscate
something.
Who they
I've read a lot of English by non-English speakers, and it feels different than that does.
Right. Feels like a fake. Yeah.
It really does. And, you can understand that. That may be what they're the
it's equivalent of ransom note.
So the files are the files that have been made available are dated no more recently than 2013. So the most recent are 3 years old. So that's, it makes people think that this has been held for a while after it was grabbed. No one understands what that means or why. I think I heard somebody on Twit suggest that it was like a field tool set and that, like an archive that may have been lost or left somewhere. That is to say, there are other feasible ways that these tools could have been obtained other than this rather romantic, we found their IP range and hacked them. Okay, maybe, but if in fact these are field tools and they have sort of a feel to them of that, then, it's very often the case that NSA people have to leave the puzzle palace and venture out in order to go to specific locations on the internet in order to get the position on the network that they need. And if they're physically roaming around, thumb drives get lost or laptops get stolen from airports, that kind of thing. So there are other ways this set of tools could have escaped. Now, all of that notwithstanding, there is some this was eyebrow raising for the security industry. There was a whole bunch of previously unknown things that were contained here. So even though they were 3 years old, everyone on this podcast knows how lumbersly? Anyway, how slowly.
That's a good word you made up.
we move forward with security standards. So 2013 is, the especially problems that have been persistent for a long time. For example, that we'll be talking a little bit later about this flaw in the random number generator of GPG. It's been there, I think, since the late 1990s. So for decades, because if it's sort of following the logic or the wisdom of that T-shirt, if you don't know it's broken, you're really better off not messing with it because, leave well enough alone. So similarly, for example, the news just today is that one of these cyber weapons, which was specifically aimed at the Cisco firewall, that the ASA line of firewalls, and that's actually where this crazy compound if statement was located. It was individually stepping through individual if-then clauses, looking at version numbers that it had retrieved from the SNMP protocol, and it's a flaw in the SNMP protocol. Simple network management protocol, which we've talked about before. It's a UDP, typically UDP based protocol that allows you to query network gear for its status. And so things like the number of bytes received and on interfaces and transmitted. And you can, if you have write privileges, you can reconfigure SNMP devices over that protocol. So it's very powerful, as it sounds, network management protocol. Anyway, the point is that the code stopped checking versions at 8 point something. And I didn't bother to remember to write down. It wasn't important, which was some years ago. And if it didn't match any of the known versions, it returned an error saying unsupported. Well, some researchers said, ASA is now at 9 point something. What happens if we tell it that it's compatible with that? And sure enough, it works. So, and I'm wondering, and I didn't have a chance to look, when it was that that version of the firmware was published, and if that corresponds with the date of this tool. Because the point is, they may have, that tool may have been current when it was last edited, which was when that 8 point something was the late most current version of the Cisco software. Because this compound if statement does nothing except turn an SMP SNMP version, short version string, into a full English statement saying, you know, this is version zum of the Cisco something or other firewall. Then the next line checks a different SNMP version and then says the same thing with a slightly different bit of text. So again, this is part of what made people feel like, wow, this whoever was writing this was being paid by the character rather than to create inefficient code. So anyway, what were found were implants, exploits, and other tools for controlling routers and firewalls, including those from Cisco Systems, Juniper, FortiGate, and a Chinese manufacturer named TopSec, and a whole bunch of other stuff. Again, batch scripts and Python written tools. The shadow brokers imagined that they were going to, I guess they imagined they were going to make a windfall from this, because they were asking for as much as 1 million bitcoins. Okay, but a bitcoin this morning was $582. So that would be $582 million, and Whoa. Nobody expects that that's going to happen. In fact, I saw a posting.
So it's just theater, in other words, that they're doing this. It has nothing. Yeah.
I saw a posting somewhere that said the highest bid we're aware of so far, and they're only 999,999 bitcoins shy of their 1 million goal. Well. So I think someone said, "Yeah, I'll give you a bitcoin." For the rest, so they're saying they're holding back the like way more the bulk of this, and for what it's worth, it would be valuable to certain entities. I think the price has to come way down for it to be sufficiently. I mean, for the benefit to match the cost, but still, If these guys didn't give us just the good parts, if there was a lot more of similar quality, despite the fact that it's kind of unimpressively written, somebody somewhere knows stuff that is not public. Cisco immediately put out a notice and quickly came up with a short-term block for this patch. They have not yet updated their firmware. But this is an example. This is whatever this flaw was in the SNMP protocol, sending that to the most recent version of firmware, after you removed that check to see whether it was a known version, it crashed the firewall. And as we know, the crash is where you begin the development of an exploit.
Yeah.
So the problem is still there in some form in the most recent firmware. So Cisco's got a job to do, because SNMP, it's not a super secure protocol. You're able to put a username and password on it, but it's much better to filter the port. So that it's a port 161, I think, as I recall. You're much better off not letting anybody see your SNMP ports, because you know that's just generally a good thing. And you know, many ports need to be public. Port 80, port 443 for the web have to be, but SNMP, you just don't want everybody to see that. You're asking for trouble. So with any luck, most organizations that are properly configured won't have their SNMP protocol exposed. On the other hand, maybe they do internally, And so this would create the ability for a hacker who was able to get in through somewhere else to then access the firewall and get up to some mischief in order, for example, to open the front door after coming in through the back door. So, wow. And again, if there really is an equal or much greater amount of similar quality, that's kind of frightening that somewhere there is a group that knows at this level of exploitation into who knows what devices. We talked a couple of weeks ago about how at the recent was either Black Hat or DEF CON, Apple gave a presentation where, among other things, they unveiled their bug bounty program. We talked about how they're going to be offering security researchers up to $200,000 if they privately disclose serious critical holes in Apple's software rather than taking such vulnerabilities and exploits elsewhere. However, there is an existing commercial exploit broker named Exodus Intelligence, and they immediately upped the ante, raising Apple's bid to as much as $500,000 for valid Apple software bugs. They are and so first of all, I read this, I'm thinking $500,000. How can they possibly afford that? Well, get this. Their business model is that corporations that want early preview or access for whatever reason can subscribe for $200,000 a year to receive comprehensive reports, proof of concepts, demos, and packet captures of these exploits, which this Exodus Intelligence group are basically purchasing from hackers who find them, pulling them all together, and then they've set up this subscription model. And it's hard to imagine that there won't be some U.S. front company that says, yeah, we need exploits for only the best purposes for our intelligence services. So $200,000, chicken feed. And I guess that's the model that these guys are using. So, and, you know, the as I said when we talked about this before, I liked the idea of Apple offering this official bounty program because it allowed researchers to dig into what, you know, Apple's code, which is about as closed as it could be. And actually, when we talk about what Matt Green and his group at Johns Hopkins found, the real lesson there is about this notion of having closed protocols and the danger of it. But I like the idea that a true white hat hacker could support themselves if they were sufficiently skilled by finding problems and having Apple pay them a fair price for their find. The problem is $500,000 is a lot more than $200,000. And, you know, you'd have to have your ethics screwed on real tight in order to say, you know, I'm going to stay with Apple. So it certainly is competition for exploits. And not just Apple, by the way. Exodus is looking for, I wrote it down. Oh, so iOS, Google Chrome, Microsoft Edge, and Adobe Flash are their official sort of platforms. So, of course, Chrome, the now the majority browser on the web. Edge, the browser that Windows 10 people are using by default. Flash, that refuses to go away and is probably a ripe territory. I don't imagine you get so much money for those Flash exploits because, as we know, they're not that hard.
A dime a dozen, literally.
Unfortunately. So, GPG. One of the other things we've often talked about is the critical need for, I want to say all I think it might be all crypto software to have a source of high quality random numbers. There are probably some modes where you don't need them, but for most things you do. So, for example, back when I was talking about Squirrel, we did a podcast on the entropy harvester, which is the first thing I wrote for Squirrel because I wanted to get that right. And what mine is doing, the code that I wrote for Squirrel, is it's continuously sucking in all kinds of noise that the system produces. Exact packet counts, exact packet arrivals, hard disk transfer rates, bytes transferred. When anything happens, keystroke timing, mouse moves, everything that's going on in the background, it's just sucking them in, pouring them into a big hash. And the idea is that, and all kinds of, at the nano level, the individual things going on in the processor, the branch mispredictions, the cache hits and misses. You know, our current processors maintain an incredible repertoire of their own internal analysis and management platform, and it's available to the programmer, and it's completely unknowable outside. So, I mean, and highly unpredictable. So the point is, I'm because there's no lack of true entropy in everything going on in the system. Oh, also how much memory every process is using and so forth. I mean, there's just all this. I'm just scraping all of this, dumping it into a hash, and that churns until Squirrel needs a random number. And many, many crypto systems are very, very hungry for randomness. Squirrel actually isn't. It doesn't need much. So that also helps to increase its integrity, because the more you need, the more difficult it can be to provide it. What typically happens is that that's the case here in GPG, is that a hybrid is created of something that harvests real entropy, which is then used to seed an algorithmic pseudo random number generator. And the problem is that it's easy to make these work wrong. It is very difficult to make them work right. And so the problem with a pseudo random number generator is, once you're able to determine its state, if you're ever able to get a snapshot of its pool of entropy, and if it algorithmically generates output by churning that pool, then you're able to predict the future of outputs. And that's exactly what this does. So some security researchers discovered what they call a critical vulnerability. And we'll back off of that a little bit here when I explain what it is, because it isn't the end of the world, and it's been fixed. In the random number generator inside GNU PG and also libd gcrypt. And those apps have been around since 1998. And so essentially, it's just been patched, but any version of GPG earlier than August 17th, that is last week, is vulnerable. This has always been there. They're all vulnerable. But again, they're calling it critical because it is a flaw in the random number generator. Turns out it's very difficult to exploit. So that's why it's not the end of the world. The vulnerability allows an attacker who can arrange to obtain 4,640 bits of entropy from the random number generator to then trivially predict the next 160 bits of output. So this is, as I said, if you can, in this case, they're not getting a snapshot of the internal state, but it turns out that due to a flaw in the mixing functions of the pseudo random number generator part of this, if you were to get a little over 4K bits out, you can then compute the next 160. So, and that's not something that anybody wants. That's just, you know, that's by definition, it's cryptographically broken if you're able to do that. So, GPG 2.1.15 is fully patched, and as of the middle of last week, and all platforms were affected because this was in the common core code of that product. Now, the researchers indicated that although the vulnerability is critical, users should not immediately start revoking private keys created with vulnerable versions. And I wrote down exactly what the researchers said. They said a first analysis on the impact of this bug in GPG shows that existing RSA keys are not weakened. For DSA and Elgamal keys, it is also unlikely that the private key can be predicted from other public information. They wrote this needs more research, but they suggested do not be overly hasty in revoking keys. Of course, you know, revoking your GPG key would cause some upheaval for everyone who would then need to update themselves in order to communicate with you. And so, you know, they found a problem. The good news, and it is a true design flaw that's always been there, but it's more of an internal issue. It's fixed. And even they say, they call it critical because, again, these things tend to, you know, clever people look at this longer and find some unseen way of extracting the earlier entropy and then can compute backwards. So it's a little bit of a flaw in randomness, which, as we said, crypto absolutely needs a good supply of. I tweeted this last week, and there was one piece of new information here that I wasn't aware of. The EFF has weighed in on Windows 10. And, you know, their headline was, with Windows 10, Microsoft blatantly disregards user choice and privacy. Now, I took a softer tone in my tweet. I just said Win 10 holdouts, not to mention corporations, would likely appreciate the EFF's take on choice and privacy trade-offs, meaning that, you know, if you're on the fence or if it's for some reason painful for you not to have moved to Windows 10, or if you just want additional justification, the EFF basically, they rant for a while. This is, you know, they're not being gentle. The first part is user choice, which they were really unhappy about, and there's no news there. That's everything we were talking about for the last year. Things like deliberately confusing dialogues leading up to the, you know, click the red X to close it, and that essentially doesn't deschedule the upgrade and everything. So, of course, the EFF thinks all of that is a bad idea. But then, of course, the second side is what Windows 10 itself does. And here was something I didn't realize. That is something that was news to me. They wrote under disregarding user privacy, they said the trouble with Windows 10 doesn't end with forcing users to download the operating system. Windows 10 sends an unprecedented amount of usage data back to Microsoft, particularly if users opt in to personalize the software using the OS assistant called Cortana. Here's a non-exhaustive list of data sent back: location data, text input, voice input, touch input, web pages you visit, and telemetry data regarding your general usage of the computer, including which programs you run and for how long. Then they go into talking about the ways it's possible to use options to reduce that level of reporting that, of course, we've covered in previously extensively. But here was what I didn't know. Unless you're an enterprise user, no matter what settings you choose, you have to share at least some of this telemetry data with Microsoft, and there's no way to opt out of it. Microsoft has tried to explain this lack of choice by saying that Windows Update won't function properly on copies of the operating system with telemetry reporting turned to its lowest level. In other words, Microsoft is claiming, writes the EFF, that giving ordinary users more privacy by letting them turn telemetry reporting down to its lowest level would risk their security, since they would no longer get security updates. And then they said in parens, notably, this is not something many articles about Windows 10 have touched on. And I never remembered encountering that before. So anyway, they conclude saying there's no doubt that Windows 10 has some great security improvements over previous versions of the operating system. But it's a shame that Microsoft made users choose between having privacy and security. So, and that's not a surprise from the EFF. I got a tweet that reminded me of several of these that I've received that I just sort of wanted to talk about, sort of a checkpoint here in August of 2016, after the January 1st midnight New Year's Eve sunset of SHA-1 signed certificates. And so the tweet that I got said, "Steve, I work for a hospital and we have an online bill pay system in place using a third-party site. When visiting the payment site in Chrome and looking at the certificate information, Chrome is telling me that the security on the site is weak." And he says, "See attached image. What are your thoughts on this?" And in fact, the image that he attached has Chrome saying that this may not be a private connection. Now, what it's doing is warning that site that he was going to was signed with SHA-1 cert, claiming that the connection might not be secure, which we know is utter nonsense.
It's just scaring people.
Yes, exactly. And Google's security engineers know it as well. On the other hand, it's one of the underlying topics of the podcast is how reluctant the industry is and how difficult it is to move the industry forward. And that SHA-1, it was time for it to die, but it has died. For example, you can't get an SHA-1 cert any longer, but the ones that were issued still exist. I tweeted back to him and I said, "Well, for what it's worth, there isn't any known actual problem with SHA-1. Everyone's just being cautious and moving away from it before it becomes a problem, because everything we've learned about the way security progresses says that someday that may not be strong enough." So I also said, "But look at the expiration date. When that cert expires, that company will have no choice but to move to SHA 256 because as of midnight of last year, or of New Year's, no CA will synthesize and sign an SHA-1 certificate anymore." So, you know, I'm of two minds. The problem is Google is doing this, and this is not just the only person I've heard this from. I get this constantly. It's like, what does this mean? And it's like, well, you know, Google knows that if companies using SHA-1 certs will get some blowback from their users, their web server visitors, who are worried by the certificate that the company is using. And so Google knows that will incent the company to move off of SHA-1. To me, that seems like overkill. Unless a problem were known, just let them expire. No one can get them anymore. So they'll, you know, within a couple of years, they'll all be gone. So anyway, it's I guess this is the tension you're going to have when it is so difficult to change things that aren't broken. SHA-1 actually isn't a problem. We just think it's a good idea to move away from it. And, you know, Google's pushing, as we know. So this USENIX paper from our friend Matthew Green, who is the professor of cryptography at Johns Hopkins, along with four, I assume they're postdocs or grad students, and you can get a lot of work done if you have enough smart grad students that are interested in a project. The paper was titled "Dancing on the Lip of the Volcano: Chosen Ciphertext Attacks on Apple iMessage." And I'm just going to quote from the abstract because this gives you a sense for what Matthew Green and his group found. Their paper, which is I think 19 pages long, it opens: "Apple's iMessage is one of the most widely deployed end-to-end encrypted messaging protocols. Despite its broad deployment, the encryption protocols used by iMessage have never been subjected to rigorous cryptanalysis." Why? Because they're secret. And we'll be talking about that once we catch up on this news. "In this paper, we conduct a thorough analysis of iMessage to determine the security of the protocol against a variety of attacks." Now, of course, this could have been done easily if Apple had published the protocol for verification by experts, but they didn't. "Our analysis," the abstract continues, "shows that iMessage has significant vulnerabilities that can be exploited by a sophisticated attacker. In particular, we outline a novel chosen ciphertext attack on Huffman compressed data, which allows retrospective decryption of some iMessage payloads in less than 218 queries, which is nothing. The practical implementation of these attacks is that any party who gains access to iMessage ciphertexts may potentially decrypt them remotely and after the fact. We additionally describe mitigations that will prevent these attacks on the protocol without breaking backwards compatibility. Apple has deployed our mitigations in the latest iOS and OS X releases." Okay, so these guys, this work was done last year, and in November of last year, 2015, they responsibly disclosed privately to Apple what they found. So Apple then revised their protocols in, as they said, in a backward compatible fashion, and we got those in March of this year in iOS 9.3 and Mac OS 10.11.4. So problem was solved. You know, I mean, so by the time this got any light, everyone should have been updated and this wouldn't be a problem. But I want to just now go over what they described as their high-level protocol analysis, because it's interesting. What they found under the key server and registration, and our listeners this will sound very familiar to people because this is what I've been complaining about from the beginning. iMessage key management uses a centralized directory server they call IDS, which is operated by Apple. This server represents a single point of compromise for the iMessage system. Apple and any attacker capable of compromising the server can use this server to perform a man-in-the-middle attack and obtain complete decryption of iMessages. The current generation of iMessage clients do not provide any means for users to compare or verify the authenticity of keys received from the server. So just to pause for a second, remember, this is why, for example, I'm so bullish about Threema or even Signal. Both of those give you explicit key management. Now, on the one hand, most users don't want that. But if you actually care about the security of your communications, I mean, if for you security is more than just, oh, yeah, it's secure, then iMessage doesn't provide that because as I've always said, they're managing the keys. And if a third party manages the keys and the third party can be subject to any kind of coercion or you know, bad employees, then you don't actually have security. You have, you know, the feeling of security. Then they continue. Of more concern, Apple's new device registration mechanism does not include a robust mechanism for notifying users when new devices are registered on their account. This mechanism is triggered by an Apple push message, which in turn triggers a query to the Apple-operated server. Our analysis shows that these protections are fragile. Then they have an Appendix A where they implement attacks against both the key server and the new device registration process successfully. That is, they demonstrate its exploitability. Further, lack of forward secrecy, which is a property that we know is important, because what that does is it means that the symmetric key being used to encrypt messages is constantly changing, so that if you capture the key in the future and you had stored ciphertext in the past, you cannot use a key captured in the future to decrypt old messages, which is otherwise a problem. Until recently, SSL, the pre-TLS protocol, did not offer forward secrecy. iMessage doesn't either. iMessage does not, they write, provide any forward secrecy mechanism for transmitted messages. This is due to the fact that iMessage encryption keys are long-lived and are not replaced automatically through any form of automated process, where, for example, as we know, Signal has the key ratchet mechanism that is constantly moving keys forward. This exposes users to the risk that a stolen device may be used to decrypt captured past traffic. Moreover, the use of long-term keys for encryption can increase the impact of other vulnerabilities in the system. For example, in Section 5, we demonstrate an active attack on iMessage encryption that exposes current iMessage users to decryption of past traffic. The risk of such attacks would be greatly mitigated if iMessage clients periodically generated fresh encryption keys. See Section 7 for proposed mitigations. I'll skip over their discussion of the fact that there is no prevention for replay and reflection attacks. And finally, just get down to Apple's use of non-standard encryption. They write, iMessage encryption does not conform to best cryptographic practices and generally seems ad hoc. The protocol, which they diagram earlier in the paper, insecurely composes a collection of secure primitives, including RSA, AES, and elliptic curve DSA. Most critically, iMessage does not use a proper authenticated symmetric encryption algorithm and instead relies on a digital signature to prevent tampering. Unfortunately, it is well known that in the multi-user setting, this approach may not be sound. In the following sections, we show that an on-path attacker can replace the signature on a given message with that of another party. This vulnerability gives rise to a practical chosen ciphertext attack that recovers the full contents of some messages. And I had in my notes here some additional detail, but everyone gets the idea. Essentially, what Apple did was, unfortunately, they rolled their own. They invented something they did not need to invent. Now, I want to back off from that a little bit, saying I'm not sure when iMessages protocol was put together. So some of these things may not have been around. Some of these primitives may not have been available. But we've covered on this podcast in the past the danger of using a signature rather than a MAC, a message authentication code, the danger of using a signature to authenticate a message. Because if there's some way for you to use a valid signature, even if it's not the original person's valid signature, but if the signature will still validate, then you can make any changes you want and then sign the message with, for example, your own signature. So long as it's part of the system, it'll be accepted at the other end. And attacks like that have existed, and iMessage is vulnerable to that attack. So the takeaway is, once again, the clear and present danger of closed protocol security design. In my opinion, it's not necessary to see the source, that is Apple source code, but documentation of the protocol would have allowed anyone who understands crypto to glance at it, and this problem would have been fixed a long time ago. Because Apple is as closed as they are for I guess, you know, corporate, commercial, proprietary reasons, they didn't disclose the protocol. So what that does is it hugely raises the bar of difficulty beyond the expertise of just being an expert in crypto. You also then have to reverse engineer an undocumented protocol from scratch. Now, there were a couple previous attempts, reverse engineerings of iMessage. So Matt Green and his group used those, but they were incomplete. So they had to do packet captures, watch this thing work, use what little was known publicly, and basically reverse engineer all of how it works in order to then look at it. And then what they realized was what Apple had done had a lot of problems. So I can't think of a more perfect example of the danger of a protocol being closed, different than the source being closed, because as we know, the being able to look at the source code in theory would let you find bugs. But in practice, lots of open source code has bugs hiding in plain sight. You just can't see them when you look at the code. That's not the way code works today. But the protocol, that is what the code was trying to implement, I would call that the policy as opposed to the implementation. The policy should be able to withstand scrutiny. And that's, for example, that's exactly my position with Squirrel, is that the Squirrel protocol is absolutely open. I talked about it on the first day that I mentioned Squirrel, and it's other people are implementing compatible clients and servers using their understanding of the protocol, because it's, first of all, very straightforward and very simple, but nothing hidden. And I think even if we're going to have proprietary closed source solutions, this is a classic example of why the protocol that closed solution implements should be public. And that is actually the rule with the rest of the internet. The internet is based on open protocol. That's what has allowed it to be as robust as it has been. Well, that and the fact that it was an inspired design from the beginning, it's got problems, things that it wasn't designed to do that we're trying to make it do, that, you know, that it's having problems with. But that's not its fault. The fact that all these RFCs are written, the documents, how everything glues together. Look at all the companies, like the router manufacturers, like, you know, Cisco and others, that are making a great living writing, you know, creating hardware and software solutions that implement that open protocol. I really think that's the future that we're going to see. This kind of, oh no, we're better than everybody else. We know how to do this right. I wanted to believe that, but this is an expose of even Apple's good crypto people didn't understand, as well as, you know, true experts who do this like for their living.
It's a classic case, isn't it?
Yeah, it's perfect.
Yeah. Is it good enough? Remember we talked about Telegram and you said it was good enough. This is good enough. It's just not strong.
Yeah. Oh, it's going to keep, you know, it's going to keep anybody.
Everybody but a state actor probably out of your pants.
Right. Yeah. And the again, even if it were public, if you use centralized key management, you can't trust it. You cannot trust it. I mean, we trust Apple, but if Apple could be compelled, as we've often said, to add another key to a conversation that would allow a non-Apple actor to have access to that messaging traffic. And they in the paper, I didn't have this in my notes, but I read the whole thing. Apple maintains in their database 30 days worth of everyone's message traffic. And my God, it's an amazing amount of message traffic. It's 200,000 messages per second. 200,000 iMessages per second Apple is currently transiting through their network. So they're maintaining 30 days of back traffic, so that devices that are turned off, when you turn them on, they're able to resynchronize themselves. We've all seen that when you bring a new device online, sync it into your Apple account for the first time, it's able to get all of the back messaging traffic that's available for 30 days. So Matthew and his group's point was that with the exploits they found, it would be due to the fact, for example, that keys are not being rotated, and that in fact their chosen ciphertext attack that leverages the fact that Apple did not authenticate messages properly, that would allow an attacker to subpoena the encrypted data from all of the most recent 30 days for a given person, and then do an offline decryption with no other information. So the fact that Apple says, oh, well, yes, we're storing it, but it's encrypted and we don't have the keys, well, that's okay. You know, Johns Hopkins does, because it wasn't designed.
That's okay, Johns Hopkins says.
So you shot me a note over the weekend, and I received a bunch of tweets about this. There was a very nice posting, a blog posting in codersnotes.com about the elegance of deflate.
Yeah, and wasn't that a great – wasn't that interesting? Yeah.
Really was.
Yeah.
And I just love encryption. I do love encryption, but I love compression. I've always been fascinated by compression. It's just been one of the fun puzzles that engages me, because it's a closed system. It's very much like, you know, like the mobile security or the mobile app puzzles that I find and share with our listeners, thanks to them sharing them with me, which are in themselves closed systems. Everything that you need is in front of you to work with, and what can you do? And compression is like that. So I wanted to point our listeners back to our podcast on that was titled Lempel and Ziv. It was podcast 205 on July 16th of 2009. So, and there's show notes. The audio is there. I'm sure we were doing video by then. So you can get it from Twit, or you can get it from GRC. Again, podcast 205, July 16, 2009. I explained in, you know, explainer-in-chief mode. We had a lot of fun visually explaining the way this very clever buffer-based Lempel and Ziv compression works. The way, and I've talked about it through the years, but it's just, it's, and it was an invention. I think it was a 1973, a patent
long
was
time
issued
ago. Yeah.
To these guys. And I think they were at IBM at the time.
Unisys. Yes.
Oh, you're exactly right. Yeah. Unisys. And the idea is that the idea was to compress data over a communications channel. And that's sort of it's weird because we don't think of like compressing a file as being over a communications channel. But the idea is that the recipient who is going to decompress it has no advanced knowledge of the contents. So the sender is able to look into the future, sort of like upstream of what it's going to be sending, if that helps them, or also look downstream, that is, remember what has been sent, but then chooses to send stuff to the recipient. And the idea is that the way the algorithm works is they each create state in the form of some buffers, which is kept synchronized. So they each end does the same thing to their state. And so the sender knows what the recipient has in their table, their state table, and that knowledge allows the sender to use shortcuts, essentially, to represent much longer runs of data which happen to appear in the recent past of the data that was sent, because that will be represented in this table. And the way this applies to file compression is that we think of the act of compressing the file as sending it. That is, we're sending it to a small file. And the act of decompressing it is we're receiving it. We're receiving the small file into a big file. And so anyway, I go into it in great detail. I think our listeners would find it interesting. I know, you know, we have so many of these things that we talked about years ago that are still relevant today. So again, podcast number 205, Lempel and Ziv.
But you don't cover deflate there, because deflate's kind of interesting because it's Lempel Ziv Plus, right?
Well, yeah, deflate. I did.
That's
actually
Phil Katz
talk
came
about
up with that with the PK Ziv, which
I did talk about Huffman coding of the tokens.
Okay,
and so Lempel and Ziv is the core algorithm, and then the idea is that because not all things will happen with the same frequency, once you have this set of things that you want to send, you're able to represent the ones that occur most often with fewer bits, and the ones that occur less often with more bits. So you get Huffman compression, which is what that's called, variable bit length compression, on top of the really cool buffer compression. So yeah, neat stuff. And that's deflate, that, you know, the gzip that's been around forever.
Yeah, pkzip.
I just wanted to mention about SpinRite that I got some nice feedback from people who were really glad that I mentioned, as I did last week, something I had never mentioned before. And that was that it's not necessary to run SpinRite all at once, that because of the fact that I made the percentage complete accurate to four decimal places, you know, 37.1234, you're able to run it for a few hours when you don't need your computer, you know, when, like overnight, and then stop it. It shows you where it was. And then next time you have some time, you're going out or you're going to sleep again, you start up where you left off. And so a lot of people appreciated knowing that. That's just, it's not something that's really apparent. In fact, I did see a little confusion of some people who didn't even know where it was in the user interface. There's one place where you, I mean, and this is one of the things that I look forward to changing in the future is updating the UI, because it, at the time it was state of the art, but that was 25 years ago. And, you know, the state has changed a little bit.
We had Alan Cooper on yesterday on triangulation. Oh, good old friend and the kind of king of the UI. And he had written in the early days, he was working in DOS, and then Windows 1 had come out. Or actually, he said, what, 0.98 or whatever. And he was writing a project manager, which ended up becoming Super Project. The CA bought it. And he said it was graphical. I said, graphical? He said, yeah. I said, were you using like the ASCII art?
The line drawing.
The line drawing in ASCII. Yep. He said, oh, yeah, that's how it was graphical. That's how Windows was graphical originally.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's how you did it, by the way, in SpinRite.
I think it's no coincidence that we just sold a couple copies.
Oh.
It must be that we have some live viewers who are waiting for me to talk about SpinRite to push the button. So
nice.
Thank you. I didn't have the loud one on next to me, but I did hear yabba dabba doos in the background. So
that's awesome.
It's appreciated. It's what keeps me here.
Yeah. I have to do something like that in this studio where you have like little sounds go off every once in a while telling us, you know.
It's funny. I also got feedback about that. Someone asked, by the way, if I was – and I never had a chance to respond, so I will hear – whether I was using some program to generate those. I talked about how when a process launches and a process stops that I have various little – just little clicky bonk sounds and things. No. It turns out that's built into Windows. You are able to associate sounds with all kinds of Windows events, like process start, process stop, you know, logging on, logging off, screen blanking, and all kinds of things. So it's all built in. If you just go into the sounds applet and poke around in there, you will see the ability to bind sounds to Windows events. Like, you know, switching users and logging on and so forth, all kinds of things. And so I have a standard set of sounds that have moved with me through the years, and that's just sort of part of my operating environment.
Fantastic. You want to take a break, and then we'll come back and talk about routers and
microkernels.
Oh, I really want to hear this. Our show today brought to you by Audible.com, the audio bookstore that I adore. I listen to Audible books all the time. Whether today I was listening on the treadmill. Sometimes when I'm going to bed at night, I'll put on an audiobook because I use the Amazon Echo, and Amazon Echo will read you. I just say, Echo, read to me. And it reads me whatever I'm listening to. Picks up right where I left off, too, whether I listen to the car or the gym or whatever. It knows exactly where I left off. Audible has 250,000 books. And I like it because, you know, I don't have as much time to read as I used to. I don't have the long commute I used to have. But I love books, fiction, nonfiction. I love, you know, I could take language lessons from Audible. They got the full Pimsleur series, for instance. I'm doing my French right now because we're going to France next month. Audible also has the great courses, which are, I mean, game theory, physics, psychology, any topic that you would learn at a university. These are university lecturers giving you the course you would be taking, and you listen to it. So that Audible lets you use the downtime, the time you can't hold a book or you're doing something often repetitive and dull, but you got to do it, like wash the dishes, walk the dog, exercise, drive to work, and drive home from work and drive to the store. I listen in these little gaps, and it's amazing how much you can read. If you fill in all those gaps, you get hours of reading every single day. Thank you, Audible. We're going to set you up with a free book when you go to audible.com/security now. You're going to be signing up for the Gold account. That's the Audible plan that gives you a book a month or credit for a book a month, but most books are credit. except for the really, 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 really long ones. You'll also get the Daily Digest of the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times, and that's all delivered right to you. You just download it. You can listen on any platform, Android, iOS, Windows, Windows Phone. I can even listen on my Chromebook because it has streaming from the website. So you can listen to your books anywhere on any topic. By the way, if you're Oprah has relaunched her book club. Maybe you read the excerpt in the New York Times of Colson Whitehead's The Underground Railroad. That is now out. So is every bestseller, plus classic fiction and science fiction. They have a program where they're reading great classic fiction. There it is. There's Colson Whitehead's The Underground Railroad. But they get you know, movie stars to read it, and it's so fun. I just love it. All of the readers are really, really good. That's one of the things that distinguishes Audible. It's not some mechanical voice. It's not some, you know, kind of not great reader. It's people who know how to read. I just saw that the Ray Kurzweil's book, How to Create a Mind, The Secret of Human Thought Revealed, is now on audible.com, narrated by Christopher Lane. Wow, that would be great. He also, Kurzweil also wrote The Singularity is Near. That's available on Audible. So you can listen to tech books. You can listen to any kind of book. But do take advantage of this offer. Go to audible.com/security now and get your first book free. You get a month to enjoy it. If you decide to cancel anytime in that first 30 days, you'll pay nothing, but the book will be yours forever. audible.com/security now. We thank them so much for their long-time support. You know, in a way, this studio, the new studio, is the studio Audible built. Audible and our great sponsors really made this all possible. So thank you, Audible. audible.com/security now. All right, Steve, let's get into it. Routers and microkernels.
Yeah, so I was astounded a couple of weeks ago by what I found in the hardware of most of our dumb routers. And it was just a trail that I was set onto because a number of our listeners like a different type of router. We've, of course, been talking about the Ubiquiti Edge Router X and the power that it offers. A number of people said, what about the, and I no matter how much I practice saying this, I cannot say it, the Mikrotik.
I think it's Mikrotik.
Mikrotik?
Yeah.
Well, that's a lot easier.
Yeah.
Oh, you're right. Mikrotik. Okay. Anyway,
Mikrotik. Could be Mikrotik. I don't know.
Could be. Yeah.
Mikrotik. Anyway, what does that mean? I don't know what that means. You've got a word I've never heard of.
It is a bizarre word.
I know necrotic, which is dying.
Well, and I was trying to say, okay, erotic, but with a mic. So erotic, Mikrotik.
Mikrotik.
But apparently it's
actually, the
Mikrotik.
Way it's spelled with the inner cap, I think it's Mikrotik.
Okay.
See the inner cap?
Oh, look. Oh, Mikrotik.
I think it's Mikrotik.
Yeah, somehow I missed that. I don't think I saw that page.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, that's on Wikipedia.
But actually, okay, so what I have in the show notes, I'm not going to go into this in detail. I just want to put it on people's radar. Basically, the show notes are 9 interesting links of surprising stuff. It turns out that the heart of, I want to say all, but at least all that I looked at, certainly many of our rather dumb routers, the ones that where we've got a WAN port and four LAN ports, and it's blue and plastic, it turns out there's in there is an extremely capable chip, the same chip as in the Ubiquiti Edge Router that does all of that extra stuff. Because it turns out that Qualcomm, I would argue, really over-designed a beautiful chip. And then no one took advantage of it. They used a minimal set of features. But in this Qualcomm chip is not only the ability to individually configure the subnets of individual LAN ports, but a complete hardware-based packet processing engine and rule-based filter system. So, I mean, it's a firewall multi-port router on a chip, and it's in the dumbest of the routers. They just don't use it because that's not what they were selling. And so when I realized, well, first of all, I was trying to understand what features this MikroTik, thank goodness that's the way you pronounce it. Now I can say it. This MikroTik.
Well, wait a router, minute, because they're from Latvia, so it's probably MikroTik.
Oh, Mikro.
isn't that where Andy Kaufman's character Latka came from, Latvia? I don't know. Say it like Andy Kaufman said, MikroTik.
I was trying to figure out what capabilities these routers had. And then I ran across this chip, and the documentation on this MikroTik site is really bad. And I should say, for what it's worth, this is not my favorite router. I looked at it. It's funky. If you have one, fine. But if you don't, get a Ubiquiti Edge Router X.
Never heard of them.
But our listeners do or have. The documentation is very confusing about like which router they have. They make like 50 of them, different models, and also antennas and things. But even among the routers, it's very unclear what they can do and what they can't. So that forced me to dig down. Well, what I found when I dug was this Qualcomm chip, and it turns out everybody's using it because it's amazing. But they're not using it for its amazing stuff. And so, for example, DDWRT that we've talked about often, which is the alternative open source, very nice firmware, which can be used on many of these routers, it is creeping into this chip further. There is a page, one of the links that I've got in my show notes at the DDWRT wiki, the page is switched ports. Separate LAN ports into another subnet, or separate LAN ports into another subnet. So that says that on this DDWRT page, they explain, and it won't, the web UI, the normal browser-based UI, it doesn't go there. You can't do that there. But you got, at the command level that you're able to get to, you can give commands that DDWRT will interpret to program these advanced capabilities that are, you know, in the cheapest router around or older router. I mean, really, the Ubiquiti Edge router at $49 is hard to beat. And it brings all of those features to the surface so that you can use the standard browser UI in order to create separate LAN ports or separate subnets on different LAN ports. But anyway, the point I wanted to make was that, to my amazement, it isn't a dumb switch or a hub that is doing nothing, even in the cheapest router. It is typically this Qualcomm part. Now, the other thing is that Qualcomm's got all this locked down in NDA. And the only documentation I could find had some poor guy's name plastered across every single page in light gray, branding him as the person who let this loose on the internet. On the other hand, it's a complete documentation for this chip, which is otherwise not public. You have to go under NDA in order to get documentation for it. Intel made me do that once when I wanted to write some code for their gigabit chip. I was like, come on, it's just a gigabit chip. I mean, it's supported under FreeBSD. I could go get their driver, but I'd rather have the official documentation. But companies are like that. So anyway, I wanted just to let everybody know that this exists, that capability exists. I don't know what you could do with it, except I know we've got tinkerers. And if you've got older hardware that isn't a MikroTik router and isn't a Ubiquiti, but it will run DDWRT, you may be able to unlock unsuspected capabilities there, which would be kind of fun. I think that'd be cool. So I was amazed that there's like an incredible packet processing computer that, and you can tag individual packets for processor level handling or local handling. So for example, that chip itself can be a hardware firewall, which in hardware follows a hierarchical ACL, you know, sequential match rule set. All that's built into the hardware. And if then more intelligence is needed, there's a rule that says forward me to the CPU, in which case, and for example, the chip itself is called a 7-port switch because 5 of them are Ethernet ports and 2 of them are processor ports. So it's not 7 Ethernet ports, but it's typically, it's technically a 7-ported chunk of silicon. Anyway, I was just amazed that that was in there. And boy, you know, if I had spend any free time, it'd be fun to play with. But I know that our listeners may have some fun with it. So I wanted to let everybody know that's there, hiding. So, operating systems and microkernels. This comes from a conversation, Leo, you were having a few weeks ago about, was it an alternative OS for Android phones? That's been one of the things that has been happening. And it might have been something that Google was doing. I don't remember now what the genesis was. But I wanted to remind people that sort of a little bit of history here, the way, like where we came from with computing. Because once upon a time, there were no operating systems. You know, those old school computers that with the raised air-conditioned floors blowing cold air up through large boxes of electronics, you know, with the big reels of mag tape going back and forth and the big huge printer chugging out, line printer lines of text. Back in those days, when a program ran on the computer, that's all that was running. So, and they were called jobs typically. And at the very beginning, you would run one program at a time. And this job would run on the machine. And in general, the operators, these things had their own operators who often wore white coats to look official.
No, I thought that was to keep things clean.
Well, I'd make sure that their salary was clearly justified. They have to, you know, because, the other thing is these computer systems were ungodly expensive. I mean, like an insurance company, a huge insurance company would have one in their main headquarters, and it would process all of their stuff, and it would run typically – it would never stop. It was 24 hours a day because they wanted to get as much work out of this thing as they possibly could. The operators ended up after a while knowing how long which jobs took. So like, you know, the East Coast payroll job would take 5 hours to run. The West Coast payroll would take 4 hours to run because there were not as many people on the West Coast back then, and like that. And so the different things they were doing they'd like run the deck of cards in that would get this thing programmed, and then they'd mount the reels of tape that the job required. And basically they were just sort of trained monkeys. They weren't programmers. They knew which button to press to start. And then they basically sort of sat around and watched the wheels spin for a few hours. And they could also, you develop some expertise after a while when the lights dimmed a certain way. They could kind of.
You got to listen to yesterday's triangulation, because this is exactly what Alan Cooper did with his System 360 or 370. Uh-huh. It's exactly what he was talking about, the disk packs and taking them out. And, right. You know, he said, I said, man, you were like the priesthood. He said, I was getting $325 an hour. It wasn't exactly high end stuff, as you said.
That's,
you know,
exactly that era.
Yeah.
And so the idea was that when a job was running, it owned the machine. And the problem was that some jobs needed lots of tape drives just because they had lots of data that needed to be shuffled around in many more places. other jobs only needed 3. But if a system had 10, then when a job was running that needed only 3 drives, it sort of bothered the boss that those was like he would like knock on the glass and ask those technicians, why are those 7 tape drives not busy? Because he knew what he was paying for those and he wanted to keep everything busy. And they just sort of shrugged and they said, you know, go talk to the programmers. They're, you know, all we do is put decks of cards in and press go. So what evolved then was first was the automated queuing of jobs in order to have to minimize, you know, to squeeze out the time that nothing was going on, because that really upset the boss. But then because this thing was so expensive, there was such tremendous pressure on keeping this busy all the time. It occurred to people that maybe they could, this thing, this machine could do more than one thing at once. There could be a supervisor that would arrange to have multiple jobs coexisting and each using the machine when it was available. For example, oftentimes, especially back in the mag tape days, it took a long time to rewind one of those tapes. And so while a tape was rewinding, the other tapes could come alive doing a different job on their drives using the computer while the other one was getting ready for its next phase. And so we moved forward little by little, basically because these things were so expensive, there was tremendous pressure to just keep it busy. And then the next change was so-called time sharing, where we sort of backed off from this notion of having jobs to this notion of having users on terminals. And a bunch of people would all be connected to this. And it was, you know, these machines were not fast in terms that we're used to thinking of today. I don't have any stats on hand. But for example, when I was at Berkeley, we had 2 different mainframes. We had a CDC 6600 and a CDC 7600. And for example, as you know, computer science students, we would punch up our cards, a deck of cards of our Fortran program, pass them to a student assistant through a little cubby hole, and then later come back in the day, and our card deck with the printout that deck generated would be in a cubby hole, and so we would pick up the results. I mean, that's literally the way this worked back then. But then we developed this notion of time sharing, where many users would be doing things at the same time. Now, not all users had the same priority. And one of the things that you got to know, for example, and this was again at Berkeley, if you really wanted to get access to the system, you would wake up at about 2 a.m. and trudge over it to the lab where there were terminals and run your project. And it would run in about 1/100th the time that it would take during the middle of the day, because during the middle of the day, the university basically had priority, and or, you know, the chem lab was doing X-ray crystallographic computations or something, and, you know, the lowly comp sci students had low priority. So you'd hit enter, and on the Hazeltine terminal, the cursor would be blinking, and you'd just wait for it to acknowledge that, you know, and you'd think, I did press enter, didn't I? Some, you know, and hoped that it wasn't waiting for you, that you were waiting for it. And in fact, when I worked in summers while I was in high school at Stanford's artificial intelligence lab, and I begged the director, Les Ernst, who was the administrative liaison with the powers that be at the campus, for access to the PDP-10 and the PDP-16 machines they had. And he agreed, but I could only use them in the evenings and weekends. Because again, the system was loaded down during the day and was slow, and they didn't want you know, any excess random stuff going on that wasn't for their main purpose. So back then you were sharing a machine, but consider what that meant. If you had much more pressure on the system, many more people waiting for it, then it was never waiting for anyone. And that meant it was busy all the time. And so you know, that was the thinking at the time. So now coming forward to present day, we're sitting in front of computers that are ridiculously inexpensive. We've got them in our pocket. We have them on our wrist. We own multiples of them ourselves, all of them ridiculously more powerful than those huge things on elevated air conditioned floors that many people were desperately trying to share back in the 1970s. So the concept of an operating system became important when programs needed to share the same hardware. It was originally, as I mentioned, called a supervisor. We now call it an OS, an operating system. And the need for an operating system reflects the fact that there are a couple things that cannot be done by the applications that are running, sort of by definition. For example, the application cannot load itself because, you know, it is itself. Even when I was toggling in the bootstrap loader through the switches of those PDP-8s behind me, you had to put in that loader in order to read the paper tape into core memory and then run the core. But the app itself, and in fact, there were some fancy tapes that had a loader on the front. So you would toggle in a low capability small loader because it was practical to key it in. It was like the minimum number of instructions just to suck in the leader of the paper tape. And once that was done, what that leader was a much more efficient loader, which would then which the preloader would load, and then it would take over and read the rest of the tape in a much more efficient fashion using a much larger loader that wasn't feasible to key in by hand. But the point is that programs need help to get going. The other thing that no program could do, but it wouldn't be practical, at least, is scheduling. That is, there are many different resources on a computer system that the programs running on it need to share. And time is one of the key resources. And so every operating system has this, it's called a scheduler, something that schedules the execution of programs. And there may not be anything that has received as much attention over the years as scheduling. There's an art and a science to it. Papers have been written, doctoral theses have been written over, you know, how to best, because it's a complex problem. Scheduling in general is a complex problem. How to maximize the amount of runtime given very complex competing requests. And ultimately, these days, we just throw more cycles at it, or more memory, or more juice, or more cores, and don't worry about it a little bit less. But it is a big issue. And then another resource which is inherently global and shared is memory. And once again, you can't leave that up to the program. The program can't load itself, it can't schedule itself, and it can't manage the system's memory by itself. That all has to be done by a third party. That has to be done by the operating system. That is, the program can ask for memory, and then the operating system decides if it can grant that request or not, based on rules, like processes could in the old days when there was very limited memory, you would have limits on, you know, quotas on how much memory a process could ask for. So a request could be denied by the operating system that says, I'm sorry, but, you know, can't give you as large a buffer as you would like to have. So the concept of a microkernel best stated is those the minimum set of services that must be provided that cannot be provided by the programs running or other services running. And so the loading of them, the scheduling of their use of time, and the managing of the sharing of the system's global pool of memory, something needs to stand back, you know, separate from the things then from the workers and manage them. Now, of course, there is much more to an operating system than just loading, scheduling and memory management. And this is where in my notes I said no battle plan survives contact with the enemy, to remind myself that all microkernels start out being perfect, pure, pristine. Oh, look, we finally got a beautiful little microkernel. And now the question is, how long will it stay that way? How long will it be before it becomes adulterated? And of course, we've talked many times about the decision Microsoft made when they moved GDI, the graphics device interface, API support, from outside the kernel to inside the kernel. They did it because crossing back and forth across the kernel boundary was expensive on the Intel architecture. There was a switching overhead that they wanted to minimize because systems were becoming so graphics intensive. So then there are a number of kind of gray areas. For example, there are many other API services beyond loading the program, scheduling the programs, and managing memory. For example, like what time of day is it? You know, for example, where there are things that many programs would want to share, then it makes sense not to have every program have to write the same thing, rewrite the same code. Now there's another thing that the OS has to manage, and that's the file system. Somehow, a file system is an abstraction of the physical storage device, such that the programs refer to entities, files, without regard for how they're stored. It's open this file that's named this and give me its data. And so notice that doesn't change if it's a FAT file system or an NTFS or a ZFS or whatever. Basically, you're asking for a file, you're insulated from the details of how the file system does that. So the question is, where should this go? Or where should these things go? We have all of the additional API services, and then, of course, device drivers. Device drivers is an example of another shared resource. Does that go in the kernel, or is that a service that runs outside the kernel that applications may be able to get to directly or may need to run through the kernel to get to? And then, of course, higher level functions. When we were talking about a couple of weeks ago, Leo, you were talking about, I think it was the little kernel.
LK, yeah.
Yeah.
This is what Google's Fuchsia is based on. Yeah.
Correct. And it all sounded fine. And then I heard that somebody said, oh, yeah, and it'll have GPU support in the microkernel.
That's not a microkernel.
Like, ah!
That ain't no microkernel.
And so this is the problem, is that there, everyone keeps trying to have a microkernel. And for the first week, you do. And but then it's just so tempting to put more stuff in there, to just say, oh, you know, let's just add this feature and that feature and another feature. And it takes some real discipline to say no, because as we know, it is very hard to make this stuff work perfectly. And you want that kernel, you want your microkernel to not be buggy, to not have memory management flaws, not have vulnerabilities in the program loader or the scheduler, or all the other things you add. For example, the GPU, the idea of having, calling a microkernel something that also supports a GPU. It's like, well, they must have had a reason. Clearly, it's because the GPU is a widely used resource. Every app in this that's running on this thing will be using graphics.
It's probably more efficient too, right? I would think. If it's in the kernel, it'd be more efficient.
Well, but yes, but it's a trade-off, because look at all the
more complex,
all
right,
the trouble that Microsoft has suffered from the fact that a JPEG can take over Windows.
Right.
That's just ridiculous. And if it were outside of the kernel, it couldn't do that. But the actual code that's interpreting the JPEG has root privileges. It's kernel code. So, you know, it can do anything it wants to. So anyway, I just sort of wanted to create some context. There is not a formal definition. A microkernel mostly represents a wish. That sort of the ivory tower academicians have this notion of a microkernel, where, and in a strict microkernel, all that other crap is outside the kernel. You apply the test. Can this be done outside? That's the test. Can the loader be done outside? No, probably. Can the scheduler be done? Well, by definition, no. The scheduler has to be in the kernel. Can memory management be done outside? No, that has to be in the kernel. So the test is, does it have to be in the kernel? If the answer is no, and the decision is therefore it is not in the kernel, then somehow you've managed to maintain a microkernel. But, you know, if the decision is, oh, it'd be, you know, nice to have it in the kernel, wouldn't it? It's like, yeah, it would, but then it's not a microkernel. It's starting to be, you know, not a maxi kernel, but still
a microkernel. A kernel, because most kernels.
Okay.
But my Mac is still based on a microkernel.
Mach.
It was originally Mach. I think it's now XNC or something.
Well, everything's based on a microkernel.
Yeah, it's all started with a
That's right.
Linux has never been a microkernel. Linux was always a monolithic kernel. That's, by the way, the opposite of micro is monolithic, which is everything's in everything but the kitchen sink.
It's kernel bloat.
Yeah, yeah.
So, okay, we will wrap up with the puzzler for next week. I don't want people to tweet the answer. You can talk among yourselves if you have some fellow geeks. This might be fun to talk about, but don't send it to me. Don't tweet it. Keep it to yourselves, and we will discuss this next week. And because what's fun about this is there are some subtleties to it. So ask Joe. So challenge yourself not only to get like the right answer, but the full answer. So here's the question, and this was a tweet I received this morning. I've often heard you talk about cryptography and prime numbers, but why can't non-prime numbers be used? So think about that.
I know why. Go ahead. I think I know why.
Don't tell us.
I'm not going to tweet it. I'm not going to Facebook it. I'm not going to semaphore
just for
it.
Yourself. It's a self-test. Why can't we use non-prime numbers?
I'm going to put my answer in a sealed envelope to prove that I
Well, if I'm wrong and I proved nothing, but if I'm right, to prove that I knew ahead of time.
Yes. Now, will this be the Schrodinger cat envelope where...
Yes, right.
where we don't know what it contains.
It's always right, no matter what happens. No, I think there's a pretty good answer to that question, actually. That's a good question. Why does it have to be prime numbers? Why does it have to be prime numbers?
Yep.
Steve Gibson is at grc.com. You know that. That's where you'll find SpinRight. Make a yabba dabba do in his office any time of the day or night.
And again, thank you. There were two actually that occurred when I began talking about SpinRight. I'm sure it was live listeners who were waiting to push the button.
That's nice.
So thank you
very
much.
That's really great. Don't wait. Do it right now. SpinRight, you also find that's his bread and butter. It's the only thing he charges for. Everything else is free there, including the latest crypto stuff, information on Squirrel. The perfect sleep formula, healthful sleep
Never
formula.
Never 10 is down to 4,200 downloads a day.
Yeah. Well, there's no need for it, right?
1.86. I don't know why. I know. It's like I still have leak test there, and people get it every day.
Yeah.
Well,
it's free. I'm going to take it. Let's get some more stuff. Free stuff. GRC.com. You can also go to grc.com/feedback to ask questions, but probably the best way to do it is go to Steve's Twitter, at SGGRC, and you can tweet him. He takes private tweets if you want to give him a lead, if you work for the Equation Group, whatever, at SGGRC. You'll also find the audio and human written transcripts of the show at grc.com. Steve does that every week out of his own pocket, and I appreciate that, Steve. And SpinRight's there. We have audio and video at our website, twit.tv/SN. You can also subscribe. You can subscribe. By the way, we've got an update. Remember, Patrick Delahanty told us that there was a script running out of Australia that was attempting to download every Security Now episode ever.
Oh, yeah. And going into the future.
Yeah.
Where
it's
no one
still
has gone
running.
Before.
He is looking for episode 577,043 today. Not kidding. This morning.
It's in somebody's closet somewhere.
He just run it and forgot it.
It's too bad because it's not going to get number 574, this one. It's shot white.
Oh, that's true. It's gone right past it. That's the disadvantage of doing that. That's right. Because you can't retroactively. Oh, I found it. That one you were looking for. I found it. Unless he's written some very good code. And I hope he has it because his memory's overflowed by now. Yes. What else? I think that's about it. We'll be back in our regular studio next week. Although this really worked well, I think it looks great. And, it's very comfortable for me. If you want to join us live, you do that, every Tuesday at 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. We will see you back here next week for Security Now.
Thanks, Leo. Secure.